You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
There's three readings today. The first one, the Gospel of St. John, the Word became flesh. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Through him all things were made. Without him nothing was made that has been made. In him was life, and that life was the light of all mankind. The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness has not overcome it. And the Word was made flesh, and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. The Gospel of St. Matthew, the Star of Bethlehem and the visit of the Magi. Now, when Jesus was born in Bethlehem of Judea in the days of Herod the king, behold, wise men from the east came to Jerusalem, saying, "Where is he who's been born king of the Jews? For we have seen his star in the east and have come to worship him." When Herod the king heard this, he was troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. And assembling all the chief priests and scribes of the people, he inquired of them, "Where was the Christ to be born?" They told him, "In Bethlehem of Judea, for so it is written by the prophet, 'And you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for from you shall come as a ruler who will govern my people Israel.'" Then Herod summoned the wise men secretly and ascertained from them what time the star appeared. And he sent them to Bethlehem, saying, go and search diligently for the child. And when you found him, bring me word that I too may come and worship him." When they had heard the king, they went their way. And lo, the star which they'd seen in the east went before them, till it came to rest over the place where the child was born. When they saw the star, they rejoiced exceedingly with great joy, and going into the house, they saw the child with Mary his mother, and they fell down and worshipped him. Then opening their treasures, they offered him gifts, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And being warned in a dream not to return to Herod, they departed to their own country by another way. My last reading, a commercial Christmas in the USA. The enormous popularity of Clement Moore's 1823 poem, A Visit from St. Nicholas, with its famous opening lines, "'Twas the night before Christmas, when all through the house not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse,' was arguably the catalyst for meshing the religious and secular sides of Christmas. As Christmas became more popular over the years, it also became more commercialized. Christians and non-Christians alike put up Christmas trees, anticipated visits from Santa Claus, Father Christmas, and shopped for gifts to buy for family and friends. And buy they did. Estimates vary, but in the US, consumers are now estimated to spend more than $655 billion annually in holiday retail purchases, $1.3 billion on Christmas trees alone. Australians spend $18.8 billion at an average household spend of $969 compared with $920 per person in the United States of America.
So today, 11 days after Christmas, in the context of an Australia which is burning, I'd like to reflect briefly on the Christmas story and the wider meaning behind it. So I've titled today's address, The Stars in the Bright Sky, from the carol, Away in a Manger, one of our best known carols. It's a story written by St. Matthew, primarily for Jewish people. That was the audience. Initially to convert them to Christianity. Early Christians, let's remember, were a breakaway sect of Jews. They wrote in the Jewish didactic tradition of the Midrashim. You don't have to take these stories literally. St. Matthew, a Jew, writing as a member of this blasphemous breakaway Jewish minority sect, may never have intended it to be taken literally as gospel truth. Truths in the tradition of the Midrashim lie within the layers of meaning through parable, allegory, and metaphor used by the writers to bring home the truths contained within. There were almost certainly other writers besides the designated gospel writer, and St. Matthew's gospel was embellished through the ages by scribes, translators into other languages from the original Aramaic. We're getting second, third, fourth hand version. Not to mention a range of recent translations slanted by the dogmas of various modern Christian sects, all claiming to be the one true faith, of course. And there are the embellishments of artists and musicians through the ages. Most of us will know the account in St. Matthew's Gospel of the birth of the Son of God. As the story goes, Zoroastrian astrologers, otherwise known as the Three Wise Men, noticed a bright star. They took it as a sign of the birth of the King, the Christ child, and they set off bearing gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. We've read all that. St. Matthew is the only one of the four Gospels to mention the Magi. The Gospel never mentions the number of Magi, and most Christian denominations have assumed there were three, based on the three gifts, but other Eastern traditions have as many as 12. Would have been quite a crowded stable, wouldn't it, if that all arrived at the same time. St. John's Gospel, the last written, makes no reference at all to the story in St. Matthew's account. It starts with a very succinct, unembellished, and rational story of creation and the arrival of Jesus. St. John wrote his gospel for Romans rather than Jews, and he chooses his words very carefully. As we've read, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. Let's not beat about the bush, he seems to be saying. The focus is on the Word becoming flesh, Jesus, instant Messiah, God the Son, God the Father, the Trinity wrapped up in that, of course. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Now, John's on something of a winner here. Doesn't every story begin with the Word? We cannot have a story without a word, or at least a pictogram. The mystery of how we got here and how the world began originated in ancient legends and mythologies. And by far the oldest and longest surviving being the Australian Aboriginal Dreamtime. Let's not forget that. Being an island at the end of the world had some advantages. Aboriginal elders were the custodians of the Dreamtime stories of creation, such as the Jabruki story told by the Kaurna elder Milarum, or Clarence Long as his European name was, to Norman Tyndale at the South Australian Museum. If you haven't read it, it's worth a read. My starting point has been a glimpse at that comfortable and familiar Christmas story. So much money is made of it. It's a commercial success. And it'll probably long outlast Christianity in its true form. However, I'm going to take us out of our mythological comfort zone. And I'm going to now go to the celestial hemisphere shining above manger and stable. A story of the creation emerges of new life, its flourishing and its demise and death. A much less comfortable story. It's a story written by scientists in words and mathematical equations, but it's a story nevertheless. It may have some backing of science, but over time, even our best myths change. So let's take a cosmic leap and find out what the stars can tell us about their creation and what they reveal about the Christian story and indeed what they reveal about us. It's my belief that we can't really fully understand that complex microcosm of ourselves and the forces within and around us without awakening our understanding to the infinite complexity of our planet, Earth, nature, the life forms it supports and that we share the planet with, and the cosmos beyond, and how that throws light on ourselves. At the tranquil end of the serenity turmoil spectrum, I like to think of the world not binary, but as a spectrum between the serene and the tumult. That's basically nature. Our moments of mindfulness and reflection are shown here. And of course, a part of our Unitarian practice is mindfulness and meditation. We recognize it from the anxiety and frenzy of life. Perhaps that's why we come here every week. The turmoil and all the gradations in between. A place like this forms something of a sanctuary. If we take the time to practice meditation, with a little discipline, we can shift our minds away from the turmoil and towards the serene. And we can set the balance for ourselves. And we're helped in this by traditional wisdoms. So what about the turmoil? We've seen it in the huge fires across Australia and the White Island volcanic eruption. In our restless moments, many of us will deliberately seek the thrill and risk of dangerous places. We've recently seen the turmoil of the White Island explosion in New Zealand. Now 19 deaths and many seriously injured, mostly Australians. Tourists have visited White Island for an adrenaline rush for many years, to experience forces unpredictable and beyond human control. It's located in the fiery volcanic ring that circles the Pacific, and we visit it at our peril. Our Western ethos and mythology and the religion which drove it has until recently regarded the resources of the planet as unlimited, and Gaia is angry. We urgently need new stories that are fully informed by science. We humans have now become the mega predators in our never-ending pursuit of growth and wealth. This has resulted in mega extinctions of species, and we urgently need to add another dimension to our storytelling. However, even we are part of a self-contained, finite, organic, and interactive biological system. The chemist James Lovelock and microbiologist Lynn Margulis jointly developed Gaia theory in the late 70s. It's largely forgotten about now. It's an intuitive hypothesis that sees the Earth as a self-regulating system, a superorganism maintaining conditions more or less hospitable to contemporary planetary biota. Lovelock and Magulus named this idea after Gaia, the primordial goddess who personified the earth in ancient Greek mythology. And it has well and truly caught up with us, as we are now seeing in bushfire-ravaged areas across Australia and closer to home, including our beloved Adelaide Hills, Mount Lofty Ranges, and now Flinders Chase on KI, third of the island burnt out. Not far away from us here are Christian churches praying for an end of a drought that, if you extend the logic, is being sent by an almighty God as punishment for our sins, rather than a consequence of our human stupidity in removing two-thirds of the world's forests within the last 2.5 centuries and destroying the large ocean kelps that combine to purge the atmosphere of its excess CO2. So let's look out to the cosmos for understanding. What does it say about us, about nature, about the universe? I'm still in awe of a starry night, especially in the Flinders. As a nerdy, I admit, 14-year-old amateur astronomer, I made a 7-inch Newtonian reflecting telescope. I ground and polished the lens myself to make a passable parabolic mirror. I did the Ronchi test did all the tests that were needed to see that it was the right configuration. I could never quite get rid of the scratches, though, because I did it in a dusty garage. At the expense of a couple of weeks of my second year high school, I might add, but it taught me a lot about optics and lenses. I sought help from Lorman and Pank. I've been going there ever since because they were so helpful. There's a plug for my sponsor. Today, my telescope is virtual. I'm a wimp. It runs from my computer, and it has all the latest imagery from the largest telescopes in the world, Hubble and other major telescopes, but it works the same way. I don't have to travel to the Northern Hemisphere to access the northern constellations. I can just simply look up the right ascension and declination of any object I want to see, and there it is. It never has the immediacy, though, of peering through your own telescope directly at the object. Here's our calm blue planet. That's a good starting point. I'm going to start at the scale we can all reasonably comprehend. Calm enough. Of course, when we go into detail, not calm. War, assassinations. And of course, we're lucky to be on that planet. We wouldn't be here if it were any other planet in the solar system. Not all planets were lucky. Consider this one that came too close to Jupiter. The greater gravitational force of Jupiter. You can see what's happening. That little planet is pinging off stuff from Jupiter because, of course, gravitational forces work both ways, but it's in the process of collapsing. It now forms part of the asteroid belt, roughly between Mars and Jupiter. In our 21st century scientific creation story, gravity rather than Almighty God now features as a key concept. As far as stars go, our Sun, or Sol, is relatively peaceful. It's 150 million kilometres away, far enough away to be comfortable. But we can see that it has its fiery side, as we're now experiencing. And of course, there are large solar flares going off, causing interference to radio communications. This is just a different filter. And you can see that there are disasters such as fires and hurricanes. And of course, solar outbursts cause all sorts of problems, interference when they occur, especially if they coincide with natural disasters. Why have I thrown this lady in? Well, she's a remarkable lady. She was an astronomer working in the early part of the 20th century. And she studied special stars called Cepheid variables in the Lesser Magellanic Cloud. And from her work, she enabled astronomers, all astronomers, to measure the distances across to the universe. Suddenly, the recognition took place that Earth was relegated not as the centre of the universe, but as a provincial backwater of a lesser-known galaxy in the universe. We became aware for the first time of the overwhelming vastness of what surrounds us. You might like to read that from a wonderful book by Dava Sobel, the glass universe, a bit like the glass ceiling. But the glass universe is simply reference to the early glass plates that were used on the large astronomical observatories or telescopes at the time. Henrietta would often pore over these with a magnifying lens in hand to look for the detail. A remarkable woman. Not all stars are as predictable as our sun. It pales into insignificance compared with supernovae such as the Crab Nebula that you can see here. That's a photo taken by the Hubble telescope, and you can see all that explosion in the form of filaments of gas and dust. It's in the nebula of Taurus, the Bull. It's about 204,984,000,000 kilometres away. And this is close to us on the celestial scale. It's within a galaxy. Here's a close-up. In the middle of that is an incredibly dense star called a neutron star. And every celestial object that I measure, that I describe from now on, I'm only giving one example from the estimated millions, even billions of examples in the cosmos. And our measure of distances from now on need to be in light years. I'll ease you over that a little bit. As we move further out, we have a galaxy very much like our own. If you like, at light travelling at 300,000 kilometres per second, that's equal to 9.5 trillion kilometres, and that's a long distance, I think you can appreciate. So that's our nearest galaxy. We're going to collide with that in about 4 million years' time. I don't think you and I are going to be too worried about that. Nearly 40 times further away again, we have a mega galaxy, Messier 87, M87 it's referred to, which has at its centre a remarkable object that's only relatively recent in discovery, a super black hole. Who's heard of black holes? Come on, put your hands up. Okay. Now, they've been getting a bit of attention lately because, as you know, astronomers have worked as a global team to photograph one. We've actually got our first photograph of a black hole. There's a shot of M87 at higher magnification, and you can see a long jet of stellar matter being ejected out from the centre. Black holes are a lot smaller than galaxies, but they're predicted to be very spectacular. An unimaginably strong vortex whose centre is turmoil in the extreme, especially for those objects drawn in by its huge gravitational field. These are the garbage trucks of the cosmos, you might say. Black holes form from massive stars, usually at or near the centre of our galaxy. These capture more than the imagination. They're not really holes, they're just incredibly dense mass packed into a small area. They form when a star runs out of fuel. And because it runs out of fuel, it starts to collapse in on itself. The event horizon is that shiny bit you can see drawing stuff in. That's an artist's impression, by the way. It's not actually a photograph, but it's pretty accurate, as I'll show. The black centre is so black simply because all objects that are being sucked in, their light and their matter, cannot escape. And because the light is drawn in at a speed approaching the speed of light, it appears black in the centre. So that vortex is drawing in matter at 300,000 kilometres per second. To give you an idea of the density at the centre of a black hole, our Sun, with a diameter of about 1.4 million kilometres, or 109 Earth diameters, would need to be compressed into a sphere only 2.5 kilometres in diameter. That is really dense. I'm not saying that our Sun will one day become a black hole. It won't. It's too stable for that. So what happens, of course, is over time, black holes suck in so much matter that they eventually lose their gravitational energy, more or less turning themselves inside out and morphing into space. Everything comes to an end. This remarkable photo is of a black hole, the only known resolution of a star, albeit a black hole. As I've said, it's galaxy M87, the very centre of it, 55 million light years away. It was taken with the world's largest radio telescope, the Event Horizon Telescope, and that's actually a global network of 8 synchronised radio observatories all working together to take that photo. What they had to do was to convert the radio waves to the red, green, blue spectrum so that we could see visible light, and that's what you're getting there. And of course, it's all due to this remarkable man and his theory of general relativity. And what black holes show is that Albert Einstein's theories are borne out in actual practice. It is a living proof, an observational proof, that the theory of general relativity was correct. And that's been further validated by that equally remarkable man who died, you'll remember, this year. He suffered from ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease. Amyotrophic lateral sclerosis is the correct name. But what a wonderful life. Some galaxies get too close to each other and their gravitational fields pull them together into one super galaxy. And there, in doing that, because the stars are relatively far apart, they can often do this quite comfortably with very few collisions. But what happens is their centres all coalesce and form into a massive black hole. You can see 3 combining together there. They'll eventually coalesce to form a huge supergalaxy. We can see back even further, even with optical telescopes such as the Hubble. And this is due to a remarkable discovery that they've been able to use gravitational fields as a lens. And they've been able to program Hubble to go right back to see galaxies right at the beginning of the universe, almost right at the beginning, 13.3 billion light years away. I've just highlighted that little galaxy there, little red galaxy, and that shows us what the galaxies would have looked like right at the beginning of the universe. So from that first point of a matter, a huge gravitational field, from that we have the Big Bang and little galaxies like this emerging and then, of course, expanding outwards. So we're looking right back there at the very old centre of the universe. Now we have the makings of a new story of creation at a scale somewhat more alien than the human-friendly biblical account, the creation Midrashim in Genesis. We are not the centre of the universe. We're an insignificant speck within the cosmos. But we have intelligence. We have the miracle of love. And that is an amazing thing. Out of the chaos and disruption of the natural world and the universe and the cosmos, we have us, a living miracle. So both begin with the word, both theories. The ideation of the best concepts available to the scribes of the ages to explain the inexplicable. And now we're drawing on relativity and quantum physics, expressed in mathematical equations which you or I probably can't understand, and helped by new, huge optical and radio telescopes. So we've been able to create this photographic timeline of some of the universe's most important historic moments, from its birth and its expansion outwards following the Big Bang to the present. And they draw on the knowledge being gained from black holes to hypothesize its eventual collapse to a pinpoint of unimaginable density and possibly its rebirth. And some astrophysicists suggest there are other universes extending on into the infinite. Astrophysicists and the scientific scribes of a new creation story might write a cosmological account, but if they're really honest, not much less mythological than the one in the Bible, and it might go like this. In the beginning, there was nothing other than an invisible source of infinite cosmic energy. Then 13.7 billion years ago, the universe formed, a moment in time, not a point in space, a moment when time began and from which all subsequent cosmological events followed. The primordial universe was extremely hot and dense. it goes to trigger off a huge cosmic explosion, and we have the universe that we get now. Nature at work on a cosmic scale. Evolution kicked in. Out of the primordial soup, we have the evolution of plants and animals, and so we get nature at work as we know it today. It's my belief that God lies within our human imagination, which I've referred to previously as the divinity within each of us. But there is divinity also in the serenity that surrounds us, but that comes along with the turmoil within and without. We're wise to learn to live with nature, and to do this we need new myths based on the best stories we can provide. And to add to those ancient myths and legends, many of us will still keep in our hearts, such as the Christmas stories and of the Dreamtime, comfortable stories on a human scale. The big challenge ahead of us will be to rein in greed with speed and restore our planet. Christianity hasn't been that good on stewardship. So God created mankind in his own image. God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds and the sky and over every living creature that moves on the ground." It will take generational change, huge resolve, huge intellect and dedicated, uncorrupted leadership, an entirely new mindset on the global economic and political order, based less on greed and much more on living sustainably within a finite earth. Can we do it? Gaia, the seemingly gentle blue planet Earth, sustains us. We need to look after it because it's the only one we're ever likely to be able to survive on. And when Yuri Gagarin became the first human to orbit the Earth in April 1961, what impressed him most was not the vast spectacle of the universe, but that little blue planet. "I marveled," he said, "at the beauty of our planet. Let us safeguard and enhance this beauty and not destroy it." Hubert Reeves, a Canadian astrophysicist, said, "Man is the most insane species. He worships an invisible God and destroys a visible nature, unaware that this nature he's destroying is the God he's worshipping." We're already near the tipping point. It's not quite there yet, if we resolve to turn it all around. We're not about to fly off anytime soon in search of some other gentle planet to colonize. And we certainly will not be able to fly out on the numbers needed to provide a sustainable and genetically diverse human genome. I suspect that's why we've never been visited by aliens. You may disagree with that, but I don't think we have. The God of love in fundamentalist traditions can also be a punishing and vengeful God. Nature shows similar extremes in our bushfires and other extreme weather events. We have evolved from nature out of the primordial soup. We are not God's grand finale of creation, as we have fooled ourselves into believing. Made in his image. We've made God in our image, and the sense of entitlement that goes with it. Nature is Lovelock and Margulis's Gaia. It's a living system of great complexity, which we are beginning to understand, destroy the web of life and the nature that nurtures us, and we destroy ourselves. Gaia, nature, shown in the Celtic Triskel, a trinity of the three attributes of life all at once, creator, sustainer, and destroyer. Each of these spirals of the Triskel trinity are found within you and me, and in all living things, and it's the balance that is important in ensuring species sustainability. All species must have once been spore, seed, or sperm, gamete and embryo, must have burgeoned into maturity and flourished, then aged, died, decayed, and been reborn out of the elements from which it sprang. It's the cycle of life, the nature of things, the nature of the cosmos, the nature of Gaia, the nature of nature itself and of all of us. So let's live comfortably with our myths when they still reveal wisdoms. Myths we understand, wisdoms we understand and would be foolish to ignore. The Christmas story in St. Matthew was written in words rather than equations. It's a story written by a number of authors and artists of a helpless baby Jesus born to give humanity focus, love and hope. Human concepts in an alien cosmos. It contains many of the ethical and social insights and understandings we need about ourselves and others that we share this planet with to give us hope for a sustainable world, a Gaia less angry. So in this 2020 year, let's all resolve to tread ever more gently upon our blue planet Earth and upon the Gaia that sustains us all. Amen. Our closing words. Trials and tribulations have a purpose. They sharpen us up, show us that we need new stories to change our ways, and they show us how. Courage shown in adversity, in the hard times, can make us all into heroes. We've seen them emerge from the ashes. Blessed are those who seek to right a wrong, to restore justice where there is injustice, to show love where there is hate, to restore what has been damaged, to heal injury, to understand ignorance, to comfort the grieving, and to bring hope to those who despair. They will have become part of that force which, for all that is good and harmonious in the world, the force that will prevail mightily over evil, the force that is the living presence of God in you and I. May that force be with you this new year and beyond. Amen.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianessay@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching Essay Unitarians.